The mountain supports life. Animals, plants, hikers, and runners use its trails to reinvigorate their bodies and minds. It's part of a culture in the city, a steadfast mother that looms over and watches out for all who live in her shadow. But at least one man is using the mountain for his own devices. He's hunting those who enjoy her slopes and capitalizing on their vulnerability. Soon, though, the hunter will be the hunted. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 156, The Serial Crimes of Blessing Bavaney. Now it's time for my monthly tip about the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And from Monday, the 17th of June, you can catch seasons 1 to 3 of The Real Murders of Orange County, exposing the shadowy side of California's sun-drenched coast. From a lethal tale of mistaken identity to the deadly pursuits of the perfect family image, each episode dives into a startling case of privilege and prosperity gone fatally wrong. Watch a standalone episode Monday to Friday at 9:25 a.m., 1:40 p.m. and 8 p.m. on DSTV Channel 170 and StarSat 222, repeated at 1:50 p.m. and 8 p.m. every weekend. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Nicolene Cook, Pamela Geary, and Chrissy Economou for your support on Patreon, as well as Nicolette Getley for your support on PayPal. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today's episode is quite a recent case that took place on South Africa's most iconic mountain, Table Mountain in the Western Cape. Of course, it involves incredibly tragic loss of life and trauma, but I also found some aspects of this case, such as the ways the criminal was tracked, incredibly fascinating. My sources for this episode include the court judgment and sentencing document, several media articles, as well as videos released by news outlets ENCA and Times Live. So, let's get into episode 156, The Serial Crimes of Blessing Bavaney.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Table Mountain is a significant landmark in Cape Town and a huge tourist attraction. The mountain is not just important to the human residents of its city, though. It also plays host to 8,200 different species of plants, some of which only exist on Table Mountain and nowhere else in the world. The mountain is also home to porcupines, mongooses, snakes, lizards, tortoises, and a rare endemic species of amphibian that's only found on the mountain, the Table Mountain ghost frog. As you head down the slopes of the mountain, you enter the Table Mountain National Park. This park and areas of the mountain are popular hiking, walking, cycling, and trail running spots, regularly enjoyed by residents of the surrounding areas. Most of the events in today's case occur in the Silver Mine section of the park. It runs northwest, southeast, across the peninsula from the Atlantic seaboard to the False Bay coast. It covers Constantiaberg, Steenberg Peak, and the Kalk Bay Mountains, also bordering on Hout Bay in the northwest, the suburbs of Constantia and Tokai in the northeast, Kalk Bay in the southeast, and Fishhook and Noordhoek in the southwest. And it's this latter section, the Fishhook adjacent area of the park, that is the predominant focus of this case. Crime on the mountain and in the park are not uncommon. Throughout the years, muggings occur, and anyone using the park is always advised to keep their wits about them, and many solo walkers or hikers will carry mace or pepper spray just in case. Because no matter how beautiful your surroundings, the possibility that you may come across a criminal is always there. In October 2017, though, a series of crimes began in the shadow of Table Mountain that was clearly different, and suddenly the safe space residents of the area had enjoyed was no longer the sanctuary it had once been. On the 11th of October 2017, David Bucklow was cycling through the Silver Mine area. It was a morning ritual he'd done hundreds of times before. It wasn't uncommon for him to come across other cyclists, walkers, and hikers. So when he came down a trail and approached a small bridge in an isolated area and saw a man on the bridge looking downriver, he initially thought nothing of it. But when David was about 10 meters away from the bridge, the man turned and looked at him, and instead of stepping aside to make space for David to pass, the man stretched his arms out and blocked his way. David decided he wasn't stopping for the man and continued at the same pace, attempting to slip through a small space between the man and the bridge railing. As he passed through, the man kicked his leg out and almost knocked David off his bicycle. Anger overtook the cyclist, and he stopped his bicycle a few meters away, approaching the man with his mace spray, swearing at him and asking him what his problem was. Even in his rage, though, something about the look in the man's eyes stopped David in his tracks. The man looked completely fearless, as though he was willing David to come closer. Realizing that the incident could be a setup too, and there might even be more assailants hiding, David got back on his bike and continued cycling away. It was really only David's skill as a cyclist that kept him on his bike that day. Most other less experienced cyclists would have come right off, gone over the bars and possibly even into the river. He knew he'd avoided serious injury that day, and although he did not immediately report the incident, David Bucklow recorded the man's face in his mind. Something in him told him he might need to identify him one day. We don't know exactly how many of these types of incidents there were with this individual in the ensuing months, because not everyone would have reported them. There may well have been dozens, But the next recorded incident linked to this perpetrator would occur 3 months later. On the 12th of January 2018, a brother and sister who were then 15 and 17 years old were hiking up to Piers Cave in the Silver Mine area. Because both were minors at the time of the crime, they were not named in the trial, so we'll call them Mary and David. Throughout their hike that day, the siblings encountered a man in a light blue collared shirt on a few occasions. Mary was instantly wary and told her brother she got a bad feeling from the man. The man greeted them, though, and told them he was up there to pray. David felt that this was an indication that the man was not dangerous and told his sister not to worry. They carried on hiking, and by the time they reached the cave, they saw the man again. Both felt that this was strange, so they decided they'd wait for him to move off and then head home. He did eventually start walking away, and the siblings waited a bit and then set off behind him. They were walking about 30 meters behind the man when he suddenly turned around and started running up the path toward them. He now had a knife in his hand. Mary and David froze in their tracks as the man demanded they hand over their possessions. He pulled Mary's phone out of her back pocket and, using a pen and napkin he produced from his own pocket, told her to give him her password, which she did. David only had a small amount of tobacco on him, which he handed over. Mary asked the man if she could take her SIM card, and he allowed her to remove it from her phone. He then told her to remove her jewelry, but perhaps emboldened by his allowance on the SIM card, Mary said she didn't want to give it to him. David started talking to the man to distract him and told his sister to run. Mary broke away and ran as fast as she could. The mugger turned and looked after her, then at David, and seemed to decide it wasn't worth it and walked off. David and Mary ran home and reported what had happened to the police. Their case would remain unsolved for quite some time, and by the time they saw the man from Silver Mine again, they'd realize how close they'd come to a far more serious outcome that day. And Mary's gut feeling had been absolutely spot on. The man who had robbed Mary and David that day soon escalated, and by the 28th of January 2018, when Julia and Doug Notton headed out for a hike in Silver Mine, he was ready to take his crimes to the next level. Doug and Julia enjoyed hikes together regularly. The couple had been married for 27 years and had 3 children together. Doug was an accomplished pilot who had worked in several countries, flying fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters. He had flown for the SAPS and in rescue operations during his career. He also did some freelance helicopter flying to show tourists the beautiful area he loved so much. Friends and colleagues described him as a perfect gentleman and a kind soul who always had a smile ready for anyone he encountered, regardless of how difficult the situation was that he was flying in. Julia often walked the park on her own when Doug was away working. On this day, though, they'd heard about some of the prior attacks, and Doug said he would prefer to accompany Julia so he was sure that she was safe. As the couple set out for their walk, the wind had picked up, and although it didn't make walking uncomfortable, it was difficult to hear one another talk. Julia was out in front of Doug at one point, and she turned around to tell him something. As she turned, she saw that a man was making his way toward them. He was about 25 meters away when she spotted him, but his pace made it clear that he wasn't just out for a walk. He was actively catching up with them, and quickly. Julia called out to Doug that they should step aside and let the man pass. She stepped off the path and turned, expecting her husband to move in next to her, but instead, she saw the man run up to Doug and with what she described as a disturbed look on his face, he pulled a knife out of his pants and started stabbing her husband in the back. Doug screamed and bent over in pain. Julia was horrified at the sudden turn of events, but she had no time to think as the man began throwing rocks at her. A few struck her in the collarbone, and she ducked down, reaching for the pepper spray on her belt. The man continued to throw rocks at her hands now, but Julia reached up and sprayed the pepper spray at him. This made the man back up slightly, but soon he was walking toward her again, and Julia realized the pepper spray was empty. She shouted at the man, asking him to leave them alone, saying he could have everything they had on them if he would just not hurt them anymore. But the attacker wasn't bothered. He pulled Doug further down the path, and as he did, Julia saw him continue to stab her husband. She realized that the only way to help Doug was to run for help, which she did. Sadly, by the time Julia Notton was able to raise the alarm and bring assistance back to her husband, Doug had already passed away from his injuries. His body was airlifted from where he had died by the same helicopter he had flown in rescue operations during his career. The autopsy on Doug Notton showed that he had been stabbed at least 21 times on his head and upper body. 6 of the stab wounds were deeply penetrating. 1 went through an artery and vein in his armpit area, as well as into his lung. Another had penetrated his brain. The attacker fled that day with almost nothing of any real monetary value. The couple never walked with their smartphones and instead had an old cell phone they used for hikes in a backpack which Doug had been wearing. The attacker had taken this backpack as well as removing Doug's shoes. Up until this point, it was assumed that the perpetrator was committing these crimes solely for financial gain, and the violence was there to subdue and frighten his victims. But after Doug's murder, it became clear that this was not the case. The killer had not even established whether Doug and Julia had anything of value on them before he began to stab Doug. It really now seemed he was just out to kill. The community of residents who frequented the mountain and the park were left in complete shock after Doug's murder. The serene and peaceful area they'd all enjoyed so many times without a care in the world was suddenly the hunting ground for a killer. There was very little for police to go on in Doug's murder. As we have discussed before, stranger murders are some of the most difficult to solve. National parks in South Africa are run by the South African National Parks Organization, and SANParks officials are tasked with working with the SAPS to ensure the safety of those using their parks. One way SANParks officials do this is by regularly ensuring that no one is breaching the borders of the parks with shelters they've built, and also monitoring individuals who've used the parks and are known for making trouble or breaking the rules. These individuals can be fined and have their identity recorded through photographing and fingerprinting to ensure officials are aware of repeat offenders. After Doug's murder, the officials went into overdrive, checking the known individuals they'd interacted with in the past few weeks, but none of the leads they had panned out. Park users were warned to be very careful when walking or cycling in the park, and many simply stopped going for a while. But there were still those who felt as long as they took precautions, it would be fine, and they continued on using the park. Just over a week after Doug Notton was murdered, the killer struck again. On the morning of the 7th of February 2018, a neighbourhood watch member, Malcolm Esterhazen, was patrolling Brigantine Avenue in Fishhook. The road bordered along Table Mountain National Park, right along the Silver Mine section. Malcolm regularly patrolled the area, and after Doug's murder, felt it was even more important to keep an eye out for suspicious activity to try and keep his neighbors safe. He was on a phone call when he saw a man appear in front of him. The man was wearing a blue collared shirt. He acknowledged the man with a nod and then continued to speak on the phone. As they passed each other, the man body slammed Malcolm. He fell to the ground on his back and immediately noticed that his attacker had a screwdriver with a yellow and black handle in his hand. The man said absolutely nothing to Malcolm as he bent over him and began to stab at him with the screwdriver. Malcolm had practiced karate for years and managed to deflect multiple blows, but despite this, he was stabbed at least 9 times. One of these wounds punctured his lung. The man eventually stopped and stepped away, instructing Malcolm to hand over his cell phone and watch. Malcolm handed them over, and his attacker picked them up, as well as the neighborhood watch radio, which had come off his belt and fallen onto the floor. He then ran off across a nearby sports field. Malcolm Esterhazen's life was likely saved that day by the fact that he was on the phone with someone when he was attacked. The person had heard him screaming, and when he couldn't get a response from Malcolm, he'd ended the call and phoned Malcolm's wife, who alerted neighborhood watch members and the police. They found him shortly afterwards, and he was rushed to hospital and eventually made a full recovery. 2 days after Malcolm was attacked, a chief inspector with the Department of Fisheries, Annelle Nortier, was travelling down Mervyn Road in Fishhook in her vehicle with a colleague. As she drove into Upper Recreation Road, which is just 500 metres as the crow flies from Table Bay National Park, a large rock came flying through her windscreen. Annelle stopped her vehicle and saw that the rock had been thrown by one of 2 men who were fighting on the side of the road. She and her colleague managed to separate the men and had them both sit on the pavement while she waited for neighbourhood watch and police to arrive. When the men were searched, one, wearing a blue collared shirt, had a screwdriver with a yellow and black handle in his pocket. That day, both men were photographed, and the man with the blue shirt was arrested. He was booked into Fishhook Police Station holding cells under the name Russell Wine. And this part of the case is, I must say, a little foggy and quite concerning. Because the man held in custody was, in fact, not called Russell Wine. He had no identification to support his name. Malcolm Esterhazen had reported being stabbed and almost killed by a man wearing a blue shirt and wielding a screwdriver with a black and yellow handle. And yet, Russell Wine was held in custody for 2 days and then released. It does not appear that Malcolm Esterhazen was informed that there was a man in custody that fit the description he'd given, and he certainly wasn't asked to attend an ID parade at that time. Rather, the mysterious Russell Wine was allegedly told he was innocent, his later words to be fair, and sent on his way. This would be a deadly mistake. On the 13th of March 2018, Ian McPherson left his home for a 2-hour bike ride in Table Mountain Nature Reserve. McPherson was an avid cyclist and had recently purchased a GT mountain bike in preparation for a race he planned to enter. His son had bought him a bunch of gear to go with the bike, including a cat cell phone, a GPS, which was fitted onto the bike, and a card which attached to it bearing his personal particulars and emergency contact numbers. Ian wanted to make the most of the early morning cool weather and had set out relatively early. At 9 a.m. that morning, Stephen Howells set out for his own morning exercise, a jog through Silver Mine. He was taken aback when a man came speeding past him on a bicycle and almost collided with him. The man was not dressed for cycling and seemed to be very out of shape for someone who owned a professional mountain bike of that caliber. Hal stared at the man as he disappeared into the greenery on the bike, and then tried to shake off his concern and continued on his jog. He didn't get very far at all, though, before stumbling upon a badly injured man on the path. The man was Ian McPherson. He was still dressed in his cycling gear and had his helmet on, but he was bleeding profusely from his abdomen, and when Hals carefully lifted the man's shirt to see what the source of the blood was, he reeled back at the large gaping hole in the man's stomach. Hals quickly pulled his shirt off and tried to stem the bleeding, telling Ian he was going to run for help and he'd be back as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, by the time help arrived for Ian, he was already deceased. The blood loss from the multiple stab wounds to his body had simply overwhelmed his heart, and he had died. An autopsy on Ian would show that the man had been stabbed with incredible ferocity. Besides the stab wounds to his abdomen, he also had been stabbed in his back and neck. The wounds to his neck had perforated bone, and three deep wounds to his chest would have been fatal on their own. That morning, Ian's wife of 47 years, Aileen, received the news that her husband had been murdered. The McPhersons were originally from Zimbabwe and had moved to Fishhook in 2006. The thief had gotten away with Ian's bicycle and his cell phone. Of course, Stephen Howells immediately put two and two together and realised he had seen the killer fleeing on Ian's bicycle. He told the gathered Sandparks officials as much, and the trail along which he had fled was cordoned off. Sandparks was about to bring in its secret weapon. Sergeant Ranger James Minier is one of only seven master trackers in South Africa. At the time of Ian McPherson's murder, he'd been employed by Sandparks for 15 years. The art of tracking is an ancient one, and it's probably important to make the distinction between ancient trackers, who originated directly from Khoi, San, and other indigenous people of South Africa and learned those skills through generations, and modern master trackers, who have learned the skills through formal means. Sadly, most ancient trackers have now almost entirely died out, but the skills used by these incredible individuals are now formalized in the master trackers of our national parks. The act of tracking is mostly geared toward following and understanding the movements of wildlife for the purposes of conservation. But as humans have increasingly intruded into natural environments, it's also become about tracking human movement to find missing people or track people with nefarious intentions, such as poachers. Trackers do predominantly use spoor or footprints of animals to track, but they also use every other way that the animal interacts with its environment to paint a picture of its movements. A piece of fur caught on a branch, a spray of pheromones on a tree trunk, dung, flattened grass, disturbed foliage. Every single part of nature gives the master tracker clues about where their target is headed and what they did in each spot they come across. Of course, the key elements of spoor tracking also apply to other impressions made in the ground, such as human footprints or shoe prints or tire tracks. So when Minier received the call on the morning of Ian McPherson's murder and was told that the perpetrator had fled on a bicycle, he felt sure he could use his tracking skills to find the killer. His first stop was not the crime scene, though. Instead, he went straight to a small, informal settlement he'd been keeping an eye on, which had just started forming right on the border of the park. He'd had to warn people several times to move their structures when they'd encroached on park land. At the settlement, which consisted of just a few structures, he spotted bicycle tracks and a set of footprints, which he knew were from a tacky type of footwear. As part of his training as a master tracker, Meunier is able to determine the age of the tracks quite accurately. He could tell the bicycle tracks had been laid down very recently. He approached the homes, but they were all empty at that point, so he instructed his colleagues to cordon off the tracks and keep an eye out for anyone returning to the homes. At the scene of MacPherson's murder, Meunier got to work. He first identified the spot at which the altercation had occurred. He identified two sets of footprints, one belonging to MacPherson and the other had to be the killer. The shoe prints he believed belonged to the killer were the same as the tacky prints he'd found at the informal settlement. The depth, arrangement and pattern of the footprints showed Meunier that the two had been involved in a struggle at that spot. It was not far from where MacPherson's body had fallen. The bike tracks that had run up to that spot, undoubtedly when MacPherson was still riding it, stopped suddenly at that point and then restarted after the location of the struggle. At first, the tracks showed the killer had walked next to the bike, pushing it along, his shoe prints appearing alongside the tire tracks of the bicycle. Then, Meunier understood, the killer had mounted the bike and started riding. The impressions were slightly different in depth from those where MacPherson had been the rider, likely due to the difference in weight between MacPherson and the killer. Meunier continued following the tracks. At points, he noticed the killer got off the bike and pushed. Perhaps he had gotten tired, or the sand had been too thick for him to ride through. The killer had pushed the bike along the park's fence for a distance, and then he'd picked up the bike and gone into the vegetation. Meunier could see exactly where this had happened, as the shoe prints became slightly different from the added weight of the bike in the killer's hands, and the tire tracks, of course, completely disappeared. He was able to follow the killer's steps, even through the vegetation, taking note of slightly bent leaves and occasionally disturbed vegetation. Sure enough, on the other side, the footprints and the bike tracks clearly appeared again, and he was led straight back to the informal settlement where he'd first identified the tracks. While there, one of the residents did arrive, and Meunier checked the man's shoes and searched his home with his consent. The shoe prints did not match, and the bicycle was nowhere to be seen. But then, a call came in from the scene. As soon as the SAPS discovered that Ian MacPherson's cell phone had been taken, they began tracking it. The phone pinged in a nearby area called Masi Pumela, or Masi for short, which is in Fishhook. As Meunier arrived at the location of the ping, a cell phone shop, he was told by colleagues that the owner was not there, but they'd spoken to him by phone and he'd mentioned that a man had come in earlier that day with a Cat cell phone to sell. The owner had told the man he only bought and sold iPhones and declined to purchase the Cat phone. The officers told Meunier that the owner would be heading to the police station to provide a full statement, but he had already told them that he knew the man who had come in by the first name, Blessing. This immediately set alarm bells off in Meunier's head. He knew that name too. Quickly, he pulled up some records from his phone. 2 days before Ian MacPherson had been killed, Meunier had been on patrol in Silver Mine when he'd spotted a man walking in an area that is closed off to the public. He'd approached the man who'd introduced himself as Blessing Veni. Meunier explained that he was in an off-limits area and asked if he could take a photograph of Beveni. Beveni apologised, saying he wasn't aware and agreed to have his photograph taken. Meunier had watched as the man had made his way out of the off-limits area. It was this photograph that Meunier now sent to the investigating officer on the case, Detective Sergeant Nicolette Damon. He added that this was not the first time he'd seen Blessing either. He'd also seen him in the informal settlement to which he had traced the bicycle tracks that morning. It would later be determined that Blessing Bhaveni was the same man apprehended by the fisheries officer for throwing rocks and fighting shortly after the attack on Esterhazen. The same man who'd been found with a screwdriver in his pocket that matched the weapon used to almost kill Esterhazen, whose shirt colour matched the description Esterhazen had given. Blessing Bhaveni was Russell Wine. He was the man who'd been held for 2 days and then released. And he'd killed Ian MacPherson not long afterwards. The owner of the cell phone shop kept to his word and arrived at the police station later that day. He said that after he'd received the call, he'd gone to a man he knew to be Blessing's uncle and had gotten his cell phone number as well as downloading his WhatsApp picture for the officers. When they compared the picture to the one Meunier had given him, it was the same man. Ian MacPherson's phone was eventually located in Massey. It had been purchased by a man called Chris Chirova, who'd exchanged his iPhone and 400 rand for the cat's cell phone. He was arrested for being in possession of stolen goods, but later released. He was able to identify Blessing Bhaveni as the man who had sold him the phone. Intelligence through informants is often incredibly important in cases of violent crime, and the informant network in Fishhook was put to excellent use in this case. Officers put out a description of MacPherson's bicycle to the network and received information that the bike had been seen in the possession of a man who owned a barbershop in Massey. Officers attended the barbershop, and although the owner initially denied having any knowledge of the bicycle, he did allow the officers to search his premises, and as they started the search, he admitted that he did have the bicycle and showed them where it was. The bike was wrapped up in plastic, and the man said he'd purchased it from a client earlier in the day, and he planned to send it to his family in Mozambique. This man was also arrested for being in possession of stolen goods, but also released. He agreed to work with police and identified the clients he'd purchased the bicycle from a range of photographs. He pointed out Blessing Bhaveni, but told police that he'd shaved the man's head for him when he'd been in earlier in the day. Ian MacPherson's son worked and lived in the United Kingdom. He and his dad had been very close, and he'd purchased many of the items that had been stolen for his dad. He also knew the bicycle very well, because his father had often video-called him for assistance when he was assembling it. When he received the devastating news of his father's murder, he immediately flew back to South Africa, and on the 14th of March, he attended Fishhook Police Station and identified his father's cell phone and bicycle. The informant's network would also lead to the eventual arrest of Blessing Bhaveni. Although the man had clearly tried to change his appearance, he hadn't really bothered to flee or try and escape justice. Perhaps he believed that the police would not be coming after him. After all, he'd managed to kill one man and almost kill another, was arrested and then released. So when police descended on his address on the 14th of March, perhaps he was surprised. He initially tried to identify himself as Russell Wine again, but this pseudonym was now known to police, so all he did was confirm that he was indeed Blessing Bhaveni. He was taken into custody without incident, and the room he was living in was searched. A blue button-up shirt was found, which had dark stains on it. This would later be confirmed to be blood belonging to Ian MacPherson. A hand radio, a silver emergency blanket, and a cycling bag were also found in his room. The radio, of course, that belonged to Neighbourhood Watch member Malcolm Esterhazen. As the pieces of the puzzle began to fall into place, Blessing Bhavini was charged over the next few days with the various crimes I've discussed so far relating to the series of violent crimes he was accused of. As we know by now, the arrest of an individual is never the end of an investigation. Often it is only the beginning, and there was still a lot of work to be done to put together a prosecutable case. Each of the various witnesses and victims were brought in over the next few months to view identity parades, although each took different periods of time to consider those presented to them in the parade. Without fail, each victim or witness selected Blessing Bhavini as the man who had committed the various crimes. Bhavini was also charged with possession of a fake passport and a fake temporary asylum visa. Bhavini was determined to be a Zimbabwean citizen who was in the country illegally. His passport and residence permit had his photo, but someone else's details entirely on them. The fake residence permit had also expired 3 years before that. The trial of Blessing Bhavini would unfortunately be significantly delayed by the COVID pandemic. When it finally started in February 2020, the state presented the testimony of 21 witnesses. These included all the surviving victims, as well as those who had either been present or witnessed the aftermath of the crimes in question. Bhavini had pleaded not guilty to all of the charges against him. In cross-examining of the state's witnesses, it became clear that Bhavini's defence was very simply that he had not committed any of the crimes, and that all the witnesses were lying, and he was being framed. After the state had rested its case, Bhavini took the stand in his own defence. Through an interpreter, he told the court that he had first entered South Africa in 2012. He had then exited back to Zimbabwe in 2014 and had returned to South Africa in 2016, where he had lived ever since. He said he had never owned a passport or a residence permit, and on all occasions he had entered South Africa by paying bribes to officials at the border posts. Bhavini did not have any alibis for the incidents in question, but simply claimed that he had always been somewhere else. He said he earned a living by buying and reselling items, and this is how he'd come to be in possession of Ian McPherson's phone and bicycle. He did not deny that he had sold the items to the two people with whom the items were eventually found, but said he had only been the middleman, and he'd purchased them from another man who he could not identify, but who must have been the real killer. It was proven that the blue shirt belonged to Bhavini because he was wearing it in a photograph taken of him when he was detained by the fisheries officer. But Bhavini claimed McPherson's blood had been planted on the shirt by police. The judge looked at the possibility of this claim and found that although McPherson's blood had been drawn during his autopsy for later comparison purposes, that blood had only been drawn after the blue shirt was found in Bhavini's room, and the photographs of the shirt taken in situ by the police officer who found it showed the stains on the shirt. Bhavini called no other witnesses in his defence, nor was any physical or documentary evidence submitted by the defence. They arrested in October 2020. By December 2020, Judge Judith Klutter was prepared to hand down her judgment. Bhavini was found guilty of all the charges against him, except for the passport and residence permit charges, as she didn't feel the state had submitted enough evidence to prove that Bhavini had actually acquired these false documents himself. The sentencing portion of the trial would begin in January 2021. Bhavini did not testify in mitigation of sentence, but his counsel did make several submissions on his behalf. He was found to have no previous convictions and was determined to be 32 years old. He had completed grade 6 in Zimbabwe, before leaving school to help earn income for his family. He'd entered South Africa hoping to find better employment opportunities, he said, and had initially worked in construction before starting to buy and sell various items to earn an income. At the time of his arrest, he was earning between 4,000 and 5,000 rand by doing this. Baveni had been married to his wife, who lived in Zimbabwe, for 14 years, and they had three children together, aged 7, 5, and 3. The last child had seemingly been conceived when he'd last been in Zimbabwe in 2016, and he had never met the child, as he hadn't returned home since then. In her sentencing remarks, Judge Klitter would say that the only mitigating circumstances she could take into account was that Baveni had seemingly not resorted to crime before the age of 29, which she thought perhaps indicated he could be rehabilitated. In my mind, I'm not sure that is an indication of that, as the median age for serial killers to start committing their crimes is between 29 and 33. The judge did state, though, that in this case, the aggravating factors far outweighed any mitigation. In considering how, once he had started committing violent crimes, he had escalated and continued to commit two murders, Klitter said that this deeply concerned her and pushed her opinion of the chances of rehabilitation more over to the side that it would be difficult to achieve, as something had clearly shifted in the man. The judge also took into account the evidence presented during the trial by Aylan MacPherson, Ian's widow, as well as his son Robert, and Doug Notton's widow, Julia. All had indicated how profoundly their lives had been changed by their loved one's murders. Robert MacPherson said he'd had to leave his job in the UK to help his mom in South Africa. His mother had been so devastated by his father's death that they'd eventually had to sell their home in Fishhook and move her to the UK to live with Robert there. Robert was only able to start working again once his mom was settled, which was almost 2 years later. The judge noted that it was clear that even 2 years after the events when Julia Notton had testified, she'd still been incredibly traumatized by having witnessed her husband's murder. She continued to run the events of that day over and over in her head and considered what she could have done to change what happened. Her three children had been left without a father, and with Doug having been the main breadwinner in the home, they'd struggled considerably since his death. The judge also pointed out how violent and frenzied the attack on Notton, MacPherson, and Esterhazen had been. She acknowledged that if it hadn't been for Esterhazen being on the phone at the time of his attack, Baveni would likely have been facing 3 counts of murder. She described Baveni as cowardly in having specifically targeted victims who were vulnerable by either being alone or, in Notton's case, with a female companion. She further acknowledged the clear and rapid escalation in violence, which was a hallmark of a killer who would not have stopped killing until he was arrested. For the murders of Doug Notton and Ian MacPherson, Blessing Baveni was sentenced to life on each count. For the attempted murder and robbery of Malcolm Esterhazen, he was sentenced to 18 years imprisonment. For the other victims, including Julia Notton, he was sentenced to a total of 15 years. Due to the handing down of 2 life sentences, all the sentences were ordered to run concurrently. After the sentencing, Malcolm Esterhazen told journalists that he did feel justice had been served. Quote, "I think Blessing doesn't really care about what he has to do to get what he wants and how much hurt, pain, and misery he needs to cause in the process." End quote. He said he would not allow the incidents to change the way he lived his life, though. Quote, "I'm not going to let one antisocial person change my lifestyle. There's a lot of weird people whose actions could change what you want to do, but at my stage in life, I just do them." I look over my shoulder a lot more, but you just get on with it. End quote. And perhaps that is what Ian and Doug would have wanted too. Table Mountain National Park was a place where they had made many memories with their families, and the same is true for thousands of residents of the Western Cape and tourists too. This has not been the last time violence has occurred on the mountain or in its park, though. Violent muggings and stabbings have persisted, but for the most part it seems that these have been committed by various perpetrators or gangs. Thankfully, we've yet to see any other crimes that speak to a serial predator stalking the beautiful slopes of the Mother Mountain, but that's not to say there isn't another getting ready to reach his own peak. Some of the most beautiful settings can mask some of the greatest horrors. And while we enjoy them, it's undoubtedly always best to do as Malcolm Esterhazen suggests and look over your shoulder every now and then. Doug Naughton, Ian McPherson, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.